This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, September 8, 2004. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. House Democrats push for a national checkpoint and ID system. John Kerry gives a major policy speech, which is short on real policy change for Iraq. And activists from over 150 organizations hold actions in a dozen cities across the U.S. to protest the Bush administration's proposed $1.6 billion cuts to Section 8 housing. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Yesterday in Baghdad, four people working for non-governmental organizations affiliated with the Italian peace movement were kidnapped by a group that has not yet been identified. Nora Barros-Freeman reads for Manuela Aldabe in Rome.
The Italian peace movement has been in shock since yesterday when Fabio Alberti of the non-governmental organization Abridged to Baghdad confirmed the news. Two Italians who have been working on water and school projects, along with two of their Iraqi co-workers, have been abducted. Alberti says his organization will not negotiate with the kidnappers. He says that responsibility falls on the government for participating in the war and occupation. Premier Silvio Berlusconi's conservative government has faced sharp criticism for not doing enough to secure the release of an Italian journalist slain last month after being abducted. During the night, peace organizations held a vigil outside a palace where the Italian government was having an emergency meeting to discuss the matter. Reading for Manuela Aldabe in Rome, I'm Nora Barros-Friedman.
For the first time ever, the European Commission has approved genetically modified seeds for planting and sale across the European Union. The commission authorized 17 different strains of corn engineered by U.S. biotech giant Monsanto. The move forces members of the European Union to allow the sale and planting of the seeds. Environmentalists have raised concerns that there are no comparable union-wide regulations in place to prevent biotech crops from contaminating organic and conventional ones. The move is expected to be unpopular in Europe, where polls show that more than 70% of consumers oppose genetically modified foods. Congress's General Accounting Office has issued an opinion that former Medicare Administrator Thomas Scully should reimburse the government over $70,000 in pay. The government watchdog says Scully ordered staff to withhold cost estimates from Congress when it was considering a controversial prescription drug benefit law. From Washington, D.C., Selena Masuda reports.
Chief Medicare Actuary Richard S. Foster accused Scully of threatening him if Foster disclosed to legislatures the real cost of a Medicare drug law that passed last year. Foster had estimated that the law would cost $100 billion, more than lawmakers had been told. The GAO found that Scully blocked him from releasing that information on five separate occasions. A 1998 law says that no federal money can be used to pay the salary of any government official who prohibits a federal employee of communicating with Congress. The American Association of Retired People, or AARP, a 35-million-member organization, supported the Republican-backed Medicare drug law, which led thousands of its members to leave the organization. The GAO determined that Scully should repay 7 months of his 2003 salary. However, the Department of Health and Human Services, which Medicare is under, will not act on that recommendation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
George W. Bush has officially lost the support of the nation's largest bloc of gay and lesbian Republicans. The log cabin Republicans have voted by a large margin to withhold their endorsement of Bush's re-election campaign. From KPFK, Auto Bogado has more.
The nation's largest organization of gay and lesbian Republicans, the Log Cabins, cites what it calls a shift towards defeating the radical right of the party by not endorsing Bush's campaign. The 22-2 vote marks the first time in the organization's 11-year history that it has not endorsed a Republican candidate for president. Log Cabin Republicans say they are dismayed at Bush's proposed constitutional amendment, which endangers domestic partnerships and civil unions and would place a permanent ban on gay marriage. In lieu of endorsing Bush's campaign, log cabiners say they will shift their support to what they call fair-minded Republicans. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
A new United Nations report on Haiti says illegal armed groups are responsible for widespread human rights abuses. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
In an interim report to the UN Security Council on the UN stabilization mission in Haiti, Secretary General Kofi Annan says the mission, currently numbering over 2,700 troops and 365 civilian police, is inadequate to establish security throughout the country. Annan is calling on Haiti's unelected government to crack down on former soldiers and paramilitaries accused of killings and kidnappings in lawless parts of the country. and it also criticizes the recent acquittal of former paramilitary leader Jodel Chamblain in a widely discredited murder trial, and says the government must take steps to end impunity. Brian Concannon, a co-founder of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, agrees the UN mission is understaffed, but says the UN can and should investigate illegal arrests and detention of supporters of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, President Bush said he supports giving a new National Director of Intelligence the authority to oversee all of the intelligence community's budget, thus supporting a key 9/11 Commission recommendation. Bush also said the White House will be sending to Congress some of its own ideas in reforming the nation's intelligence agencies. Today, House Democrats slammed the Republican leadership for not quickly moving the 9/11 Commission recommendations through Congress. However, some lawmakers want to take more time, as some of the recommendations could lead to the creation of checkpoints throughout the country, national ID cards, and allow the CIA to partake in domestic surveillance. Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
A day after the Senate, the House Democratic leadership introduced legislation to implement all 41 recommendations by the 9/11 Commission. At a news conference, Democrats spent the entire hour bashing the House Republican leadership for not acting fast enough on these measures. Representative Jane Harman is the ranking Democrat on the Intelligence Committee.
And we should hold markup hearings now, not in 3 weeks, not in 10 weeks, not after we adjourn, not next year, but right now.
While most of the Democratic press conference was spent assailing the Republicans, rarely were the actual bills and policies discussed. This, while some feel that intelligence reform done too quickly could be rife with consequences, such as allowing the CIA to conduct domestic surveillance. Free Speech Radio News asked House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi if such a change, though not specifically laid out in the bill, was possible.
I would proceed very cautiously in having the CIA involved in domestic surveillance, but we will have to make some way is that we can protect the civil liberties of the American people as we protect and defend their safety.
If the risk is allowing a CIA to gain some role in domestic operations, then Pelosi's reforms and all the other reforms are going to be worse than the current situation.
Mel Goodman is a former CIA analyst and is now a senior fellow for intelligence reform at the Center for International Policy. He says greater cooperation between the FBI, which is bound by domestic laws, and the CIA, which isn't, could be an unholy alliance that Congress should seriously consider while moving forward on reform.
We're talking about the CIA monitoring and penetration of the anti-war movement in the late 60s and early 70s. We're talking about CIA penetrations of the mail system. So when you look at that kind of activity, creating a precedent for what could be happening in this current situation, because once again this country is at war, and I worry about the kind of overreaction that wartime activities bring.
The 9/11 bill, as is, would make significant changes to domestic security for years to come. The bill would create a network of screening points throughout the country's transportation system. The bill also calls for minimum standards for driver's licenses and personal ID cards. Representative Jim Turner, the ranking Democrat on the Homeland Security Committee, would not directly answer a repeated question of whether this could mean the creation of a system of checkpoints throughout the country.
I don't know that it does so. There are efforts being made today to have checks back from the border, but all of that is rather sporadic. And as I said earlier, when you know you're releasing 23,000 people into this country from places other than Mexico, you know that we have a serious security gap that terrorists could exploit.
Not all Democratic lawmakers are eager to pass all of the 9/11 recommendations immediately. Representative Maxine Waters represents L.A.
I worked for years to get rid of a national ID card in South Africa. You know, the thought of that kind of system in the United States bothers me. I've got to learn more about what it is they contemplate. And as I'm hearing, checkpoints, I've worked against police profiling. And so I have to be very, very careful about putting my name behind any measures that could lead us back into those kinds of situations.
Do you think we could be moving too fast in implementing some of these provisions out of the recommendations?
Well, you know, this is an election year, and you know, a lot of people want to go home saying that we have implemented the 9/11 Commission reports, but I would like to see some more hearings out in the states.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich on Capitol Hill.
With the latest kidnapping of two Italian nurses in Iraq, aid agencies in Iraq today said they are strongly considering a pullout from the country. This latest kidnapping comes on the heels of stepped-up demands by hostage takers for the release of the French journalists. This as the Defense Department today announced that the U.S. death toll in Iraq surpassed 1,000. Today another soldier was killed in Sadr City, the site where yesterday two Marines were killed along with over 35 Iraqis. These deaths follow Monday's attack that killed 11 Marines. Joint Chief of Staff's General Richard Myers, responding to the latest U.S. Marine deaths, admitted that the threat to the U.S. soldiers is growing, and he pledged to keep fighting.
The enemy is becoming more sophisticated in its efforts to destabilize the country, and recently we've seen an increase in the number of suicide attacks. We are aggressively seeking and capturing those insurgents who, while not willing to do so themselves, are encouraging people to commit suicide attacks. Make no mistake, we will continue to pursue those who seek to disrupt progress in Iraq.
Meanwhile, in Cincinnati today, Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry gave a speech in which he promised immediate health care for all children from day one of his administration, while saying the Bush administration has squandered money that should be used for education, jobs, and beefing up the armed forces.
When I'm president, America will once again stand up to our enemies without destroying or denying our best hopes here at home. We'll strengthen our military in order to meet new threats, but we'll also build and lead strong new alliances around the world.
In what the Kerry campaign told FSRN would be a speech laying out the candidate's policy on Iraq, there was very little detail of actual policy shift away from that of the current Bush administration.
We need to train Iraqi military and police. We need to train them more rapidly. We need to behave like we really are a nation at war, and we need to get other people to behave that way with us. We need to get more people in greater numbers ready to take over the job of protecting their own country. That's what I'll do as Commander-in-Chief, because that's the right way to get the job done and bring our troops home.
Critics charge that Kerry has no plan to bring the troops home, as he pledges, because he's yet to lay out a specific exit plan. On WBAI's Wake Up Call program this morning, we spoke to Dr. Imad Salameh, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the American University of Technology in Lebanon, and Dr. Frederick Pearson, Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Wayne State University, about their assertions that a U.S. exit from Iraq is indeed possible and within a short period of time.
If we revise, I believe, a sound policy, if we increase our cooperation with regional allies, with the countries surrounding Iraq, if we are to make our exit realistic, we have to cooperate with people in Iraq as well to allow for consensus among Iraqis. So I think Iraq could maintain its strong, independent, and free presence with the proper assistance, international and regional assistance.
So it seems largely also like a question of political will. How do you transfer sovereignty? Obviously, there's a lot of claims of transferring sovereignty. What does that actually look like on the ground in Iraq, Dr. Pearson?
What we're proposing, I think, is a more concrete plan that has actual aspects of an exit strategy about it. Neither camp has been willing to do that. As far as internal Iraqi politics are concerned, the essence of our proposal is that there has to be, as quickly as possible, an all-national election for a new government in Iraq. Influential ethnic and confessional leaders have to be brought together to create a power balance situation. We also, by the way, pose a first step as required, the first step being a United Nations call for a regional summit conference on the future of Iraq, which would involve key neighboring states, Turkey, Jordan, the Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Iran, naturally the major powers of Europe and the United States, and probably Russia, but also countries influential in the region such as Egypt, so that there is an atmosphere of greater environmental support for a peace settlement.
Dr. Frederick Pearson, director of the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at Wayne State University. With the presidential election expected to be very close again this year, the margin of victory could be provided by absentee voters. This week, September 3 to 11, is Armed Forces Voters Week, when members of the military and their dependents are urged to register and request absentee ballots if they haven't already done so. Absentee voting has grown more popular over the years, but as Kelly Ramirez reports, the process has its pitfalls.
The most common reasons for voting absentee are age, disability, and being away from one's polling district on election day. This year, as many as 6 million soldiers and civilians will be away from their polling places on election day because they are living abroad.
If you're employed by a U.S. firm overseas, or you just are an expatriate who desires to live overseas, you haven't forfeited your right to vote.
Charles Abel is Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness.
The Department of Defense is charged with providing voting materials to those folks as well.
The Defense Department is concerned about overseas votes arriving too late to be counted. Late absentee ballots are also a problem stateside. Thad Hall, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah, is co-author of a study called Whose Absentee Votes Are Counted? According to Hall, failing to send in the ballot on time is the major reason absentee votes don't get counted. Hall also says voter error in filling out the ballot is another reason absentee votes get rejected.
People don't fill out the envelope correctly. When you submit your absentee ballot, you have to complete the information on the absentee ballot envelope that says who you are and what your address is, and then you have to sign it. And people in the hurry to mail their ballot off just make small mistakes in that, and those mistakes can result in your ballot being rejected.
In many states, absentee balloting qualifications and procedures have been eased to encourage more voters to participate in elections. For example, in the presidential battleground state of Oregon, all voters are absentees. Oregon votes by mail. But the state still has something it calls absentee voting. An Oregonian can request that a ballot be sent to an address other than his or her residence. Nearly two-thirds of the states now permit fax delivery of blank ballots, and almost half the states permit the return of a voted ballot by fax. Much press has been devoted to security problems in electronic voting, but Andy Stevenson, associate director of Black Box Voting, which has turned up many of those problems, also has concerns about the security of absentee voting, at least where he lives, in King County, Washington.
In King County, the ballots are collected by a private company, and there's not really a clear chain of custody with them from the time they leave your hands until they get to the county elections office. And the company that's running them has a tendency to hire people that are straight out of prison. Now, I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but, you know, it does add an element of worry in my mind.
Stevenson said he did not know about security issues in other counties. Christine Heffron, chief deputy with the Los Angeles County Registrar Recorder's Office, says her county's procedures are secure. Their contract workers are county employees.
LA County hires all of our own internal staff to process absentee ballots, and it's all done internally. We have a contract staff that comes in, and they work within our building under the supervision of our permanent staff here in our absentee section.
Heffron also says that the popularity of absentee voting has grown over the years since California opened the absentee rolls to all its voters in 1978.
For this particular election, we're anticipating somewhere around 700,000 absentee ballot requests. And of those, roughly 80% will actually vote their absentee ballot and return it to us. Some will go to the polls on Election Day.
Nonpartisan information on absentee balloting for all states is available at www.activevoteamerica.org. Voters can also contact their county registrar's office. The federal postcard application for an absentee ballot is available at www.fvap.gov. That's www.fvap.gov. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
President Bush visited Florida today for the third time in the past 4 weeks, this time to survey damage from Hurricane Frances and make a formal announcement about $2 billion in federal aid that was allocated Tuesday night in the wake of Hurricanes Charley and Frances. But some elected representatives say the FEMA money won't necessarily get to those who need it and accuse Bush of using these two storms to his political advantage in the contentious state of Florida. From WMNF Radio in Tampa, Andrew Stelzer has the story.
During Andrew, there was a good deal of concern about the lack of concern on the part of the federal government to Florida.
Russell Dines works at the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware.
Now, of course, you have the added advantage of having a governor who's a brother to the president, so I suspect that that level, there's a good deal of attention paid to that.
When Hurricane Andrew hit southern Florida in 1992, the senior President Bush was criticized for reacting slowly. That lesson has colored the federal government's actions this summer. Last month, when Hurricane Charley was overturning mobile homes, trucks filled with food, water, and ice were already on the road from Georgia, Alabama, and other parts of the southeast. With Hurricane Frances still an active storm across the Gulf of Mexico, a Republican-controlled Congress rushed the $2 billion emergency aid bill through Tuesday night, just ahead of President Bush's trip to Florida today. But in the 3 weeks since Hurricane Charley, it's become clear that the federal aid coming from FEMA is hardest to get for those who need it most.
Renters are in a lot worse shape. I mean, we have ceilings that have, you know, caved in and they're not getting anything. And management isn't moving on it.
Stephanie Porte is an organizer with the Central Florida Office of Association for Community Organizations for Reform Now, or ACORN. Her group passed out over 5,000 flyers to people in low-income neighborhoods who had damage to their homes. While homeowners have been getting checks in about a week, renters have to wait for their landlords to apply.
We've been battling with this all day. We tried to get code enforcement out to the apartment complexes. We've called neighborhood services of the county. We have people calling FEMA, but nobody really cares about the people in the apartment complexes at this point.
Many people who rent homes have also lost their jobs, and in many cases, the first week of the month means that rent is due without any income to pay for it. Eugene Bregency is a public affairs officer for FEMA.
Our assistance is not income dependent. It's damage dependent, and we work on a first-come, first-served basis.
First-come, first-serve means that people without phones or electricity are beat to federal aid. While FEMA claims that the money won't run out, Florida Senator Bill Nelson wrote a letter to President Bush yesterday saying that with $7 billion in damage from Hurricane Charley and several billion dollars more expected from Frances, the $2 billion promised by Bush is not much more than a good start. FEMA also realizes the limits of their funds and is asking people to first try to have damages paid for by insurance.
Of course, we want that first call to be made to people's insurance companies and get that process started. And we would expect to be that second call.
While insurance companies have seen thousands of claims pouring in, Russell Dine says that many won't be paid because of hurricane exceptions in the contracts specifically designed for Florida.
Insurance industry is getting increasingly skeptical, I suppose, about the cost of hurricanes and the cost of homeowners insurance. And some people get more than replacement cost, but a lot of people don't get much at all.
Meanwhile, the media's focus is on President Bush as he handed out bags of ice to the newly homeless in Fort Pierce. Stephanie Porte with ACORN says that while it may get votes from those watching the storm on TV, people whose lives have been destroyed are not impressed.
We're trying to get the garbage to be picked up in a lot of these neighborhoods. It hasn't been picked up since before Charley, and just skipping them by, essentially. And local news is like, oh, well, Bush is in town. We got to go cover him.
John Kerry and John Edwards both have canceled visits to Florida because of the two hurricanes. Kerry said he thought it was disrespectful to make a visit that could appear to be campaigning during a disaster. President Bush says he expects another aid bill to be in Congress soon. Today was his 27th visit to the state since he took office. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
President Bush has made significant efforts to remove barriers that faith-based organizations historically have had to overcome to access public money. Bush has established offices in the White House and throughout the government to advance his initiative. And while the Bush-Cheney campaign is making its faith-based initiative a major part of the re-election campaign, critics are raising questions about the constitutionality and consequences of President Bush's actions. Jenny Johnson reports.
In the 1996 welfare bill that overhauled previous welfare policy, then-Missouri Senator John Ashcroft authored a provision that allowed faith-based organizations that perform social services greater access to federal grants by loosening restrictions. From there, President Bush has made it a major initiative of his presidency to bring more religious organizations into federally funded programs. Days after coming to office in January 2001, Bush established the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives by executive order.
Sometimes the old way hasn't worked. Sometimes the prison system needs a little different look to it. Sometimes the drug and alcohol programs need a different curriculum. Sometimes the probation office need help in their mission.
While the administration has noted that public money may not go directly to worship or proselytizing, the faith-based initiative is meant to strengthen what Bush calls their works of compassion and healing that secular organizations do not provide. A new report by the Roundtable on Religion and Social Policy documents the shift in federal funds to religious programs. Of the $14.4 billion awarded in federal grants, the White House claimed 8%, or over $1 billion, went to faith-based organizations. The initiative has faced criticism that religious teachings that reflect the administration's views have been favored over others. Stanley Carlson Thies, a former appointee to the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, says where the money goes is generally a mystery.
Nobody knows how it's distributed. We know in that one competition, Compassion Capital Fund, that it didn't go to any Jewish or Muslim groups. As far as I know, it was a fair competition, and that's the way it turned out. There are some stories out there that officials are biasing the process, and I'm sure that's happening. I think it's regrettable.
Health and Human Services reported a 41% rise in grants to faith-based organizations in fiscal year 2003, where the types of programs funded also changed. HHS has begun to emphasize abstinence-only programs to control teen pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases, while curtailing comprehensive method programs. Other emphasized public programs include marriage promotion through TANF, faith to finance education, and pathways to prevention that promotes faith as an alternative to addiction. Americans United for Separation of Church and State's executive director, Barry Lynn, says the initiative violates constitutional barriers. Lynn cites a speech Bush gave in New Orleans,
where he said that he wanted to fund programs that saved Americans one soul at a time. One soul at a time. I mean, does he think he's the theologian in chief? But now he seems to feel that it is his responsibility to save the souls of Americans using tax dollars. And in that same speech, he picked up a Bible and he said, this is the rule book that these groups, meaning the groups that were receiving money from the faith-based initiative, should follow, that they didn't have to worry about government rules.
In addition to the White House office, Centers for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives have been placed by executive order in 9 federal government departments, including the Departments of Education, Justice, Labor, and the Agency for International Development. States are also encouraged to set up their own offices. AU's Lynn gives his version of the meaning behind the initiative.
Increasingly, they become hostile to almost any group that is not clearly in line with kind of evangelical Christian principles.
Other critics say the initiative is part of a larger effort to privatize services and shrink the government, or that it is aimed at voters, reinforcing Bush's core constituency while hoping to broaden appeal to African-American voters. For Free Speech Radio News, in collaboration with Anastasia Gniezditskaya, I am Jenny Johnson.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.